It's been called the Buried in the Backyard murder trial, but it's even more sinister than that. Not only was he buried in the backyard, but it seems like his wife tried to pin the murder on their 7-year-old daughter. This is the story of Lori Shaver, the woman who says she had no idea her husband's body was under her fire pit. Hi friends, I'm Katie and this is Katie Does Crime. Thank you for joining me for the first time if you're new here. I'm a Midwesterner who now lives in New York City, putting my writing degree to use by researching true crime cases that interest me and hopefully you. And hello to the usual rapscallions and reprobates. Please consider subscribing or joining me on Patreon if you'd like to hear more true crime stories. In February 2018, one of Michael Shaver's friends called the Lake County Sheriff's Office on the outskirts of Orlando, Florida. This friend said the Walt Disney World monorail technician hadn't been seen for years, and he wanted a wellness check conducted. When deputies talked to Michael's wife, she said he'd been gone since 2015. She let them look around the house, but her attitude changed when they started poking around outside. She drove off and told them to contact her lawyer, although she didn't, you know, tell them who that was. 36-year-old Michael and his wife, Lori, had a bit of a history between them, so maybe it wasn't so odd that he just ran off. In 2014, they were having an argument about a home repair, which will not seem so unbelievable to anyone who's put together an IKEA cabinet with someone they previously thought they loved. Lori said Michael grabbed her upper arms and pushed her against a wall, hard enough that her biceps bruised. They fought over a gun, and in the struggle, Lori hit Michael over the head with it. He was arrested for DV, a phrase I don't think I'm allowed to say on YouTube. The charges were eventually dropped, but unfortunately, their two young kids had already seen the destruction of their parents' marriage. In the last months of their relationship, Michael and Lori were openly dating other people. Lori and Michael met each other in kindergarten and started becoming close friends in 7th grade, in a tiny town in New York where they only had a handful of kids in their graduating class. They were both socially awkward, so they sort of clung together in school. They got married in 2006, and Mike became a commercial pilot for the old Pan Am Airlines in New York City. They moved to Florida, but Mike kept commuting to NYC every week for work, so he was gone all of the time. Their relationship was strained. Then, after 2015, a neighbor said that Michael used to be out working in the yard until he just wasn't there anymore, and some other guy had moved in. Michael's sister said Michael was a wonderful, caring man who would give the shirt off his back to anyone who needed it. His two children were his absolute world. He loved his family, and we love him so very, very much. We miss him terribly. We are looking for answers. Michael's dad said he was just a great guy and real laid back. About 2 weeks after the welfare check that turned up nothing, authorities named Lori a person of interest in Michael's disappearance and got a search warrant for the property. Remembering that Lori seemed uneasy about the backyard, they focused on a fire pit outside that had a suspiciously shoddy concrete slab, in their words. A cadaver dog alerted on the area twice, so they brought in the heavy machinery to begin digging. A neighbor said that at one point, the investigators started high-fiving. Another neighbor said they took off their hats and appeared to pray. 3 feet below the concrete, they had found what they believed was a human arm bone. As the search continued, they found more remains. That June, the bones were identified as belonging to Michael. A cause of death was still unknown.
The Lake County Sheriff's Office says after hours of searching, they began focusing their efforts around this fire pit, later revealing they believe they found what appears to be a human arm bone. The investigation starting a couple weeks ago, after a friend of 36-year-old Michael Shaver contacted deputies, saying he hadn't seen Shaver since 2015. Detectives say Shaver's wife, Lori, also claims to have not seen her husband in several years, but investigators were forced to get a search warrant when she refused to let them look in her backyard. Neighbors say the couple has young children who often play outside.
The only thing we really care about is the kids. So we kind of had hoped that didn't get confirmed because what do you tell a 3rd grader?
It took 2 years, but 37-year-old Lori Lee Shaver was arrested for murder in September 2020. And I love how her mugshot is serving Princess Mombi from Return to Oz. She had told people that Michael just quit his job and left, which seemed strange to friends and family who knew his kids were everything to him. Back in November 2015, Michael and Lori had seemed cold toward one another when a coworker of Michael's saw them at a tractor show. Michael texted that guy 2 days later to say he was leaving his job to work on his marriage. He told friends to leave him alone, messaging, "Don't bother me." Again, that wasn't like Michael. Authorities now believe that Facebook messages sent from the family's IP address were sent after Michael's death, meaning Lori was the one to send them. She told some people he moved to California, to others she said Georgia, and to others she said New York. She told one person he was just a pilot who was always off somewhere in the world. She told another that he hadn't paid his child support and was in jail. She liked to tell her friends that he wouldn't leave her alone, that he was stalking her. The really wild thing is that Lori started sleeping with a new guy in September 2015, a couple of months before Michael disappeared. But to keep up the appearance that he was still alive, she sent flowers to the guy's wife as if they were from Michael. The note said, "Roses are red, violets are blue, my wife is a whore, your husband is too. Sorry about this. Check your Facebook message. We need to talk. Mike." Lori used her own bank account to pay for the flowers. So slick. But I mean, she had to because she had already drained Michael's bank account and even taken out a loan in his name that was delinquent. She tried to get some money by selling Michael's tools and guns, but she didn't have the title to his truck, so she couldn't sell that. It wasn't repossessed until February 2016, meaning it sat at the house for months after he had supposedly run off. I can't remember the last time a murderer was so obvious, and yet it took years for someone to get nosy. What really tipped off Michael's friend, the one who made the welfare check call, was discussing the disappearance with an old girlfriend. They started talking about, you know, the fact that their friend Michael hadn't been seen in years. And the woman said that one time when she visited the house, she saw Michael's phone and wallet there, even though he had supposedly abandoned his family. Then she mentioned the new fire pit and the awkward concrete slab Lori was posting about on Facebook, and they were like, "Wait a second." What I love is that Lori was out there bragging about the concrete that the authorities called shoddy on social media. She had even etched her name in the concrete above Michael's body. He was never seen after November 7th, so law enforcement thinks he was probably killed sometime between then and November 10th. He was shot once in the back of the head. His remains were wrapped in a tarp, a fitted sheet, and those ratchet straps you see on semi-trucks to hold cargo down. He was buried in a shallow grave beneath the fire pit the family would enjoy without him. Lori was originally held without bond on charges of second-degree murder and accessory after the fact, but months after her arrest in December 2020, a judge allowed her to be released for $50,000. And that's where things got really crazy. If you already thought Lori Shaver was kind of a crappy person, hold on to your butts. In May 2023, Lori's attorneys filed a motion saying it was her daughter who killed Michael. They said her daughter, who was 7 years old when Michael died, had confessed to the murder. The story was that Michael was abusing Lori, so the girl grabbed one of the multiple guns in the home. Lawyers asked for an evaluation of the girl, who was now 14, and said she wanted to testify. Oh yeah, and the lawyers also said that the man Lori was having an affair with fired a second shot at Michael. Now, knowing what you know about Lori trying to let her daughter take the fall for the murder, let me play you a bit of this video she made with her attorney about how much she loves her kids.
My name is Lori Filmer, also known as Lori Shaver, and as my attorney, Mr. Wiggs, has just stated, he is representing me for the charges of second-degree murder of my ex-husband, Michael Shaver. I'm coming before you guys today just to let you know that we have our suspicions, but I don't know why I've been targeted, why I've been set up, or charged with this heinous crime. I am not guilty. And anybody that knows me knows that my life is my children. I am a daughter, I'm a friend, I'm a neighbor, I'm a servant of God, I'm a wife, and I am a devoted mother of four. My life is my children. The well-being of my children has and always will be my top priority. And that is the reason that I would never cause any harm to the father of my children.
Lori went to trial in September 2024, and both sides opened with strong arguments. The prosecution said Lori had sold off Michael's things because she knew he was never coming back. Her defense said Michael was a possessive, combative, and destructive husband who needed to be stopped. Friends and family testified that Michael just stopped talking to them, disappeared, which was unlike him. When his mom got sick, Michael didn't come to visit her in the hospital. One friend from Michael's mechanic apprenticeship at Disney World said he saw aggression between Michael and Lori from both sides. He said he had to get between them as they argued once and that Lori was waving a gun around, saying she was going to hurt herself. When the prosecution asked if Michael had hurt Lori in any way, he replied, "No, he would never." Lori's new husband testified that Lori told him she and Michael had divorced and that Michael didn't care to see the kids. On the stand, he said she didn't want to get married to him at first because of the extreme trauma and abuse of her previous marriage. But the prosecutor reminded him that in his deposition, he said it was because she had financial issues. The new husband said, right, it was because of both of those. But it kind of sounds to me like he had been coached to change his story to fit this narrative of Michael being abusive. This man helped Lori pour the cement slab for the fire pit in 2016 and said nothing seemed weird about it to him. He said when Michael's remains were found, he didn't ask any questions. But two people close to this new husband testified that he said Michael was no longer walking the earth, implying that he did know something about Michael's death. Lori's husband said that he didn't say that statement exactly, but the court cut him off when he tried to start a monologue about how his words had been misconstrued. He was like, "Thank you for bringing that up because there's a point of clarification." And the judge was like, "Oh, not a chance. I'm letting you give a Shakespearean soliloquy here, buddy." On cross-examination, Lori's lawyer let the husband talk about his statement, and he said he didn't know anything specific. He said that just the way the authorities came to the house with such force, he was pretty sure this wasn't just a welfare check. So that's what made him think Michael must not be walking around anymore. It's not a terrible excuse.
Law enforcement questioned you in the yard whether or not you saw anything unusual or anything of that nature.
Oh, during the interview, law enforcement asked me if I had ever seen anything unusual. And I pointed a place out in the very back of the yard and said, if I had to point something out, I would say this is, and it was a large mound. It was a large mound of dirt. So I pointed that out. The officer had the property pulled up on his phone, Google Earth, and he proceeded to point me towards the fireplace and ask me if there was anything unusual about the fireplace. I said, no. I said, the only thing that I've ever seen unusual is this large amount of, very large amount of dirt in the back of the property. He then directed me back to the fireplace. And he did that a few times. And I just told him, I said, I have no idea what you're talking about.
The defense was trying to present the idea that maybe the guy Lori was having an affair with was just defending Lori from the abuse of Michael. So Lori's daughter took the stand to validate this idea that her dad was aggressive. The 15-year-old said she couldn't handle her dad's violence toward her mom, who was her best friend and mom in one. She said their home was tense and combative, and that she wasn't allowed out of her room when Michael was home because he worked nights and needed to sleep. She said her mom and dad had bad fights a few times a month. She cried as she described how she would tuck her mom in and give her a favorite stuffed animal for protection. She said that on the morning of the shooting, her mom and dad were arguing, and Michael pulled Lori out to the porch and held her there. She said he pushed Lori to the ground and kicked her in the stomach, so the girl grabbed a gun and shot him. If you're watching this on YouTube, you'll see the back of Lori's head during this video to protect her daughter's identity.
So we're out on the porch, and he pulled her by the arm, and he pulled her into her lap onto one of the porch chairs, and he held her there, and then she was like, "We can work things out. Like, we'll figure this out. It'll be different." And he was like, "No, there's no next time. There's no figuring it out." And he pushed her onto the ground. And he started kicking her in the stomach and in the back. And then he took his other foot and he put it on the side of her face. And she was screaming. And he was like saying there's not going to be another time. And that he was going to kill her at this time. And I heard my mom screaming for help, obviously, and then He put his foot on the side of her face and pushed it into the ground. And I didn't hear her anymore. And, sorry. And so I went to my mom's room. And I went at her end table. And I grabbed her gun. And I went back out. And I went to the door. The door was already open. And he had my mom on the ground still. Still holding her to the ground, still kicking her. And I shot him.
The kind of interesting part to me is that the girl says her dad was sitting in one of the porch chairs when he was holding her mom down and kicking her. It seems to me like it would have been hard to have control over someone while sitting, especially when this guy was 5'8 and 150 pounds. But let's go with it. The girl goes on to say that the man Lori was having an affair with was at the house and took the gun and shot Michael again. Then he told the kids that they had to go to school and keep quiet about what happened, or he would do the same thing to her and her brother, which is a pretty major threat. But she said she was able to just go about her day at school because these kinds of things happened at their house, no big deal. Prosecutors made it clear that though they had met with the girl multiple times and heard her story, she had never told them this version of the story. And also, the man Lori was having an affair with testified that he didn't even know Michael. And also, Michael had only been shot once, so there's no way both his daughter and this boyfriend shot him. Some people have questioned if the daughter will face perjury charges for making up this story, but it seems unlikely to me that anyone will blame her when it's likely that her mom manipulated her into saying all of this. Lori Shaver, now Lori Filmer since her marriage, took the stand and cried through most of her testimony. She said that with Michael being a pilot and being gone all the time, she wanted to file for divorce years ago. Her family was helping her get set up for her new life. She had a rental house and everything. But one night she came back from the gym and got into the shower, and she says that when she came out, Michael was there and punched her in the face. She said she was out of work for 3 weeks, and then they all went to live together again. The judge wouldn't let Lori give specifics about this altercation, but it sounds like the implication is that she was beaten into submission and stayed with Michael because of it. She said sometimes the abuse would happen around people, that Michael didn't try to hide it. No one, of course, testified about ever seeing Michael be violent. But Lori said he controlled her so much she wasn't allowed to leave her house. She said Michael controlled her eating to the point that when she reached for an Oreo one time, he threw her off the couch. Now, one interesting thing is that Lori was able to explain why people said she was telling them Michael left and went to Georgia or New York. Here's her testimony.
There was a witness that testified that you had reported that he had gone to Georgia or New York or somewhere.
I had received a message from Stacy.
Who's Stacy?
His sister.
Okay.
She had contacted me saying that she hadn't heard from Michael. And I told her I did not either. And she said, well, his mom is sick. So if you can, if you hear from him, or you can let, I said, if I hear from him, or I will let one of his friends know that his mom is sick so that they can relay the message. Frank Merritt came by. I told him that his mom was sick. So if he seen him, to let him know. Frank Merritt was not close with us. So I never told him that he went to Georgia. I said he went to go see his mom. Here is the misconception. His mom, Sharon Shaver, the one that was sick, lives in New York. Frank Merritt did not know the family well enough at that time. He automatically assumed, in my mind, that he went to Georgia to see his stepmom, Sharon Shaver.
I see. Okay.
I never made the statement he went to Georgia. I said he possibly could have went to go see his sick mom.
I don't know if it really changes anything. Lori still seemingly lied to a bunch of other people in a bunch of other ways, but it seems like a believable story to me in a way. It was funny to me that Court TV called her testimony pitiful because I actually found Lori pretty likable on the stand in her direct examination. I felt for her when she cried, although I may be the most gullible person in the world. And also, direct examination is rehearsed beforehand with the lawyer, so you have to take it with a grain of salt. Lori also said that because of the battery incident against her in 2014, the Department of Children and Families had offered to move her and the kids and change their names to protect them. But she declined the offer because she felt she and the kids had moved enough and she was in counseling for codependency, so she thought she was strong enough on her own.
Because we had already moved so much. We finally were in a good school. The kids had good friends. And there was a point where Isabel had asked, you know, is this where we're going to live now? And I said, yep, we're never moving again. This is where we're staying. They went to a great school. Great friends. So when DCF came in and offered that, I'm like, nope, I'm strong now. I'm going to go to counseling. I went to Celebrate Recovery for codependency. I was going to live stream counseling. I thought I had it. So I'm like, nope, I'm going to stand my ground.
Okay.
And so I didn't leave. Dated. Obviously, those relationships sucked, failed. And I went back. I loved Michael.
When Lori described the events that led to the shooting, her story was similar to her daughter's, but there might have been one thing her daughter didn't know. Lori had allegedly gotten pregnant by the man she was having an affair with, but had already taken care of it, as they say. So she said when Michael was kicking her in the stomach on the front porch, it was for a particular reason. She said that Michael told her, "This time you're not getting away," and it felt like a real threat to her. Lori didn't say anything about the man she was having the affair with threatening the kids if they told anyone what happened, but of course there's a chance that he said he would kill them out of earshot. She said he took care of the body while she was getting the kids ready for school, and she had no idea it was on her property. Their relationship soon ended when she found out he was trying to work things out with his wife. She said she can't remember the exact date that Michael was killed, but it was May 2016, not November 2015. But then why did no one hear from Michael after November? On cross-examination, the prosecutor noted that out of all of the area in that huge backyard where the cement slab could have gone, Lori happened to pour the concrete right over her dead husband's body, when, of course, she claimed she didn't know it was there. Quite the coincidence. He also noted that the withdrawals from Michael's bank account happened in the town where Lori lived, which wouldn't make sense if he had supposedly run off somewhere. When the prosecutor said the activity from Michael's Facebook account had come from the same IP as hers, she suggested that maybe he was the one logging into her Facebook account from wherever, even though she had previously testified that no one had ever hacked her account. Honestly, bless her for trying. The man Lori was having the affair with, the one she accused of shooting Michael, testified that Lori wanted him to leave his wife, but he didn't want to, and Lori was upset with him for refusing to leave. He said he wasn't there when Michael was shot, he didn't have any altercation with Michael, he didn't shoot Michael, and he didn't dispose of Michael's body. He also said he didn't get Lori pregnant.
At any point, did you arrive at the Shaver residence or any other place where Michael Shaver had been shot?
No.
At any point, were you involved with any sort of altercation with Michael Shaver?
No.
At any point, did you shoot or injure Michael Shaver?
No.
At any point, were you involved with disposing of the body of Michael Shaver?
No.
His cross-examination was kind of fun to watch because Lori's lawyer kept trying to catch this guy in lies, and he would just look confused and say, no? So the lawyer would be like, oh, so you went over to bang Lori as many as 3 times a week, but you only met the kids a few times? And the guy would be like, it was lunchtime? They were at school? Lori seemed to be defensive in her cross-examination, while this guy just seemed a little befuddled. In closing arguments, the defense said that there wasn't enough evidence to prove that Lori had shot Michael. The prosecution said it sure didn't look great that Lori had known about Michael's death for years and never came forward, all while pretending that he was alive and off somewhere, not paying his child support. It took the jury fewer than 4 hours to find Lori guilty of the murder of Michael Shaver. They believed she was the one in possession of the firearm and that she shot him. She was found not guilty of accessory after the fact, which I think makes sense because if she committed the crime herself, she didn't help anyone else commit the crime. Kind of interesting that they were hedging their bets and were going to get her on one or the other, though. Either she did it or she helped cover it up. Sentencing is scheduled to take place in November, and she could serve life in prison. A couple of things stand out to me in this case, like the fact that Lori never called Michael once he disappeared. If she was telling people that he wasn't around because he was in jail for not paying his child support, wouldn't she have called him at least one time to get that child support? Another thing is that even though Lori was dating people outside of her marriage and clearly had several affairs, she called Disney World and reported Michael for dating one of his coworkers while he wasn't even living at home. To me, it just reeks of jealousy. It also sounds to me like jealous Lori was probably upset that her married boyfriend broke off their affair after she got a heart with his name tattooed in it above her lady parts. So she decided to pin the murder on him. Of course, letting her daughter confess to the murder is the wildest part. Usually in these sorts of cases, moms will do everything they can to protect their kids, not shove them under the bus. I'm not saying Michael didn't abuse anyone because I don't know, but this was obviously not the way to handle it if he did. What we do know about Michael is that he loved his kids and fixing airplanes. His sister said he was such a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful human being who loved with all of his heart, and he didn't deserve this. They never do. Thank you for tuning into my podcast episode. I'm just a true crime fan like you are, and I really appreciate you taking a chance on me. Please subscribe and tell a friend if you like spending this time together. You can also find me on YouTube in the flesh by searching Katie Does Crime.